Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Well, good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well-Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly vigorous, relentless, and sometimes ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the very well-armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. My pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. With a face for radio and a voice for silent movies, my name is Nick Clark. I'm the president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well-Armed Radio. And encourage you to be part of the show with your calls, your comments on the Well-Armed Radio MeWe page. That would be MeWe.com/P/Well-Armed Radio. And we will keep one eye on the chat. Did I say that? You can also interact with the show using the chat function on Blog Talk Radio if you're listening live. Apologize. There's no sneeze button on the Well-Armed Radio, or excuse me, there's no sneeze button on the Blog Talk Radio control page, control panel here. So sorry for my excessive noise there in the microphone. So interact with the show by calling 563-999-3787. Again, 563-999-3787. Or you can type in the chat, which is on the chat function through the Blog Talk Radio page. Or you're welcome to send a message again through MeWe. If you're listening to the podcast, you're welcome to send me an email, nik@wisconsincarry.org. A couple people have done that in the last few weeks, which I appreciate. It's good to hear from people who listened to the show and enjoyed some of the segments. And appreciate that. So start the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here. And as always, first few minutes of the show here, anything you'd like to discuss. I say this, we don't usually, most people listen to the show via podcast. We don't get a lot of live listenership at this time of year. In the winter we do, or we did. We'll see if that changes this coming winter. But partially my fault for having scattered start times. Also, I think it's a little bit more difficult without being able to being banned from fascist book. That's where I used to have a pretty good following for the show. I think it was like 1700, 1800 followers of the show there. So when I posted a link to the show, it went out to people quickly. But I think on the our MeWe page, we might have, I don't know if it's 600. I'd have to look here real quick. I think I'm on the page now. Oh, where am I at here? Well, I'm radio. 562 followers. And people just, you know as well as I do, people just, they don't check MeWe as often as fascist book. So I think that's also another reason. And it's a little frustrating. It's harder than I thought it would be to be banned from fascist book. I never had even had so much as a warning. My personal page, I posted nothing political on. Just here and there, a picture of my fiance and the dog, and here and there, a picture of being on the boat, and that was it. So it had to be something political with Wisconsin Carry, with Well-Armed Radio, something of the sort, the New Berlin Taxpayers Alliance, which I was I founded the New Berlin Taxpayers Alliance, just a local group here in New Berlin. But anyway, so on with the show. Thank you for tuning in, however you are tuned in, whether it be to the podcast or for those who listen live. First thing I was going to talk about here, and I guess I always feel an obligation if I mention or do any kind of promotion of the show in the Wisconsin Carry Facebook group. Here I go. The Wisconsin Carry MeWe page. If I do any kind of promotion of the show in the Wisconsin Carry MeWe page, I always feel compelled then to have to have something specifically gun-related at the beginning of the show. Because without that, I would feel guilty promoting it on the Wisconsin Carry Facebook page. There I go again, the Wisconsin Carry MeWe page. So we've got something here today. This is 2021 Senate Bill 516. As I read and understand this, it appears to me that a bill has been introduced. Basically, it's a universal reciprocity bill. At least that's how I read it here. 2021 Senate Bill 516. This was introduced on August 19th. Introduced by Senators Dewey Strobel, Felzowski, Ballweg, Bradley, Nass, Roth, co-sponsored by Representatives Gundrum, Tittle, Allen, Armstrong, Branchin, Cabral, Guevara, Callahan, Dittrich, Endming, Horlocker, Knodel, Mako, Magnifici, Moses, Merso, Nalen, Penderman, Rosar, Sortwell, Steffen, Tauschen, Tussler, Vandermeer, Wichkers, Skronsky, Schra, and this has been referred to the Committee on Insurance, Licensing, and Forestry. This is, again, Senate Bill 516. This is an act to repeal one statute and amend another. Here's the analysis by the Legislative Reference Bureau. Under current law, the Department of Justice issues licenses to go armed with a concealed weapon. Department of Justice may issue a license only to a Wisconsin resident or an active military member stationed in Wisconsin, and must conduct a background check on the applicant to ensure the applicant is not prohibited from possessing a weapon in the same manner as a Wisconsin licensee if the out-of-state resident has a valid license issued by another state and the issuing state is on a list that the Department of Justice maintains of states that perform background checks on applicants before issuing a license. That sounds like the biggest run-on sentence in my life, but I think just the nature of legislative text, that's how they state it. Moving on here, this bill removes the requirement that the issuing state be on a list maintained by the Department of Justice. Under this bill, an out-of-state resident may go armed with a concealed weapon in the same manner as a Wisconsin licensee if the out-of-state resident has a valid license issued by another state. So what it appears, as I read this, it appears that this is a universal reciprocity bill. If you have a concealed carry license from another state, a valid concealed carry license from another state, no matter what the requirements of that state are, no matter what the background check procedures, protocols, if you have a valid license issued by another state, you may carry in Wisconsin in the same manner that Wisconsin residents carry. This makes common sense. It's just like a driver's license. If you have a driver's license from another state, it's recognized in all the other states. You have to follow the laws of the state that you're in when you're in them. But nonetheless, your driver's license is valid and is recognized by every other state. So this has been introduced. I think I saw a companion bill that was introduced in the assembly. That's where, you know, bills, there has to be a bill in each house. If they're passed with identical language, then it goes to the governor. If they're not passed with identical language, I think one bill goes to the other. The Senate bill goes to the assembly, and the assembly would have to pass it in the exact same format. I think if there isn't, if there's a difference in language between the Senate bill and the assembly bill, then what they do is there's a conference committee that comes up with the language of the final bill. And then I believe that has to be voted on again by each body. I'm not 100% sure on that mechanism but they do need to ultimately pass the same bill in the assembly and the same bill in the Senate in order for that to go to the governor's desk for signature. So we'll see what happens with this. It doesn't seem like an extremely controversial bill if you would ask me. In fact, it seems, again, common sense. But being that Tony Evers is as anti-gun as they come, being that Democrats would do anything to keep people from exercising their Second Amendment rights, it seems to me like this would be something that Tony Evers would have no reason to sign. Silence the old phone here from my fiance sending me a text message thanking me for an awesome weekend and for taking her golfing today. So yeah, we'll see. Again, this bill doesn't seem extremely controversial. It seems like the kind of thing that maybe they could get Tony Evers to sign. Then again, being completely anti-gun as Tony Evers is, it's completely plausible that he would veto this bill. I don't know when it comes to maybe that could be another angle here that they're thinking of is a veto override. If Governor Skeletor was to veto this Senate Bill 516, if it were to pass, and again, this is first got to pass the Senate, got to pass the Assembly, and then make it to his desk. But perhaps that's a angle that they might be looking here as well. Because again, it doesn't seem like a controversial bill. There are people, Democrats, I'm thinking of Lena Taylor, who's not anti-concealed carry. I don't think she's pro-constitutional carry or anything like that, but she's not anti-concealed carry. I think she even voted for the concealed carry bill when it was Senate Bill or Act 35. I forget what the bill, Senate Bill, oh gosh, was that Senate Bill 90 or 90? I don't remember. SB 90, I think was. Anyway, we'll see what happens with this bill. We'll try to keep an eye on it and keep you guys informed here on Well Armed Radio. Just want to remember 9/11 a bit. Yesterday was September 11th. It's 20 years, which just seems, you know, it was especially September 11th. I don't know what, in its own right, September 11th has always made me very reminiscent, very introspective, very sentimental. Just because it was, that would have happened. So 2001, I would have been in my mid to late 20s. September of 2001, I would have been, maybe 20. Well, 2001 minus, I think I would have been 26 when September 11th happened. I remember I was working downtown, I was working downtown Milwaukee at the time for a software company that was located north on the river. And so it wasn't in the central business district. It wasn't amongst the high rise buildings in downtown Milwaukee, but, you know, being in my, you know, mid to almost to my late 20s, I felt like a kid at the time. I mean, you know, you weren't a kid. I mean, you know, kid would be, I think, you know, 18 or under either. But I felt young. I felt very young in my career, very young compared to my, can't say your peer group, because your peer group would be the same people of the same age, I think. But, you know, amongst my, you know, just when you're in your 20s, you know, professionally, you're usually working with people that are older than you. I was in sales, so corporate business-to-business sales. I was in corporate sales, so you're out meeting with clients, and they all tended to be older than you. It felt like a kid at the time. And I remember September 11th, the things that really stick out to me, and there's so many, but as I reminisce, as I get, you know, sentimental about September 11th, and it's always been, even, you know, when it was 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, it's always been a very somber date, and a date that I, just because, as it was for everybody, it was so, and we've got SW for me, which I don't know if that's Scott, but anyway, great to have you in on the chat. Thanks for joining us live here on Well Armed Radio. But September 11th, you know, just it was so, such a monumental event in anyone's life who was old enough to remember, which I guess would probably put you, I mean, you know, if you were 4 or 5 at the time, you probably remember it, but it might, you know, you really don't get it. But I would say if you were, you know, 7, 8 or older at the time, it's something that you really understood the full impact of, perhaps. And it was probably it was the Pearl Harbor of our generation, generations. I mean, you know, the boomers experienced Pearl Harbor as well as September 11th. But it may be fair to say that the baby boomers wouldn't have, because the baby boomers came after World War II. And so I guess they would probably be too young, because Pearl Harbor started World War II. The point I was trying to make was, now that we passed the 20-year anniversary, I don't just remember September 11th. I remember how young I was when September 11th happened. And being so young, I think that it was easier to take. It was easier to stomach. When I say that, I'm talking about the change to society. I remember being frustrated. I remember I used to, again, I was in my 20s at the time. I was single. And Sundays used to be here on the chat. Someone says Kennedy was about the same thing for boomers. Yeah. Scott, I think it's Scott. I'm glad you said that, because that's what my mom said. My mom is a baby boomer, and she used to tell me the same thing. She remembers being on the school bus when Kennedy was shot, the Kennedy assassination, President Kennedy. And same thing for her generation. They all remember that. September 11th being so much more impactful, though, because it changed so many things. The things that really stick out to me the day of, I woke up, I was working at this software company downtown, which I kind of had banker's hours there. Sometimes I'd roll in around, 9 or 10 o'clock and try to get there at 9, usually not work 9 to 5. And, but the owner of that software company, he was super flexible and let me come in, whenever I wanted to. So I got up, was watching the Today Show. The Today Show runs on an hour delay in the Central Time Zone because the Today Show runs live on Eastern Time. So if you're in New York watching the Today Show, it's running effectively live. And maybe there's a, minute delay or 15-second delay or something, but it's essentially live on the East Coast, but it runs on an hour delay in the Central Time Zone. And the Central Time Zone and the Today Show goes for, I don't know what it was, 2 hours or 3 hours. I don't know what time the Today Show runs, if it was 6 to 10 or 7 to 10. Anyway, the Today Show was still going on, being filmed in New York, but on an hour delay here. So when they said, good morning, it's 8 o'clock, when you would watch that in the Central Time Zone, it was actually an hour delay because that was 8 o'clock New York time. Now it's 8 o'clock Central Time. Well, anyway, so they cut in to the live show, and then they said, hey, it was Matt Lauer and Katie Kirk, and he's like, yeah, we're cutting in live because a plane has apparently flown into one of the World Trade Center towers here in New York. And so they're talking about that, of course, and everybody knows this, I don't need to restate, the second plane flies in, the first plane flew in, and I remember thinking to myself, God, what, I it had to be an air traffic control mistake or something, and I thought, man, someone, with all the computers that maybe run air traffic control stuff, did someone give an aircraft taking off from JFK or LaGuardia a wrong vector and it sent them right into the World Trade Center? It just seemed like the initial thought was that it could be an accident. And then the second one that flew in, the first thought through my head for a split second when the second one flew in was like, whoa, something must be going haywire at air traffic control. Heads are going to roll over this. And then all of a sudden you'd realize it was like, no, that there's no way this is intentional. And then, everybody else on the TV comes to kind of the conclusion at the same time. It's just that split second when the second one hits where you thought, whoa, this air traffic control, computer system was it hacked, was it it just, and again, that was just a split second thought. But then so I go downstairs to get ready to go to work. I work downtown, so I was getting dressed, I was in my bedroom, and then still watching the Today Show on my TV down in my room, and I heard, I think it was Katie Kirk, they were talking to I think his name is Nick Lashevsky, who is the Pentagon correspondent for NBC. And so they're not just talking to him on the phone, and he says, hey, I'm at the Pentagon, and I got to tell you guys, I just felt a big explosion here. There was a big explosion. The walls shook, and he's talking to the host of the Today Show live, and they said, oh, well, Mick, be careful. If you got to, he's like, yeah, I need to go. So then I get in the car, my truck, and I start driving downtown Milwaukee. And at this point, you kind of realize that it appears that America was under attack. So I'm driving down 94 to go downtown to Milwaukee. And at the time, the only real tall building was the U.S. Bank building. The Northwestern Mutual Tower didn't exist at the time. It was just the U.S. Bank building. So I'm driving down 94. You come past the stadium. You kind of come up a little bit of a hill. And then you can see the U.S. Bank building. And as I'm driving downtown with all the stuff happening in the world and their planes are being flown into high-rises, first off, I didn't know by the time I got downtown to my office, again, on North Water Street, which is away from the high rises in Milwaukee, because if I had worked in the sections where the high rises were, perhaps I wouldn't have even gone to work that day, just out of abundance of caution. But, it would just, so let me see here. I got to beep that, someone might be commenting on the show here on Well Armed Radio. Sorry to. All right, let's see here. No, nope. That was just someone following the page. No, why is it? Nah. Anyway, Not sure I'm getting that. Back to my point. So I'm driving down 94, and all I can think to myself is, am I about to see a plane fly into the U.S. Bank Center? And I'm literally looking around the sky thinking I might see that. I might see a jet fly into the U.S. Bank building. I thought it was unlikely because Milwaukee's Milwaukee. I mean, it's Chicago and the Sears Tower. I mean, they were evacuating the Sears Tower, which now is, I guess, called the Willis Tower. Or maybe it's changed names again, but they were evacuating the Sears Tower because that was a potential target. I mean, these high-rise buildings in major cities, and Chicago being a more major city than was Milwaukee. So that seemed more realistic that people at the Sears Tower would have more of a reason. Again, Milwaukee being like a second tier city, you know, your Houstons, your Denvers, your Miamis, those are places where you would think, okay, you know, maybe more of a target of opportunity for the terrorists. But it was just weird to be driving down and looking at the sky, literally wondering if you were going to see a plane fly into the U.S. Bank building. We didn't know at the time how large, how widespread this terrorist attack was. There was people who thought maybe there were dozens of planes. I mean, remember when the information was so scant initially, like, oh, there's this many planes we can't contact. And there was talk of this plane over Pennsylvania that they lost control or air traffic, that they had lost radar contact or air traffic control had lost communications with, that wasn't responding to. So it was just this, this big time of unknown. And that was weird, because that was, you know, just a surreal experience. But so that was like the day of for me. I mean, and I remember when the buildings fell, I couldn't believe that the buildings, I thought, man, these have to be engineered better than that. But when they come crumbling down like they did, I mean, I thought it was just going to be a big, you know, fire rescue operation. There was going to be a lot of people that died, but it was going to be a big fire rescue operation. Then to see the buildings actually collapse was just, again, surreal doesn't even describe it, but it was just, it was unbelievable. And then the things that really stick out, I remember like it was either the next night or there was a day after there was people, there was like a night where we had candlelight vigils and you like, I drive home from the gym late in the evening and there was just, and everybody was out on their front porch with a candle. It was something the kind of mass gathering / mourning that you'd never experienced before. But then the other thing that sticks with me is I remember when we didn't have metal detectors and body screening everywhere that we go. And September 11th really ushered that in. And these are the changes, the bad things. I used to like to ride my motorcycle, and I would stop by the little park and watch area by Mitchell Field where you could watch jets take off and land. And it was only a couple hundred yards from the edge of the airstrip. And so it was really cool. It's fenced area. You pull and you park. I mean, I remember my stepdad took us there when we were little just to watch planes land. And I thought that was the coolest thing because, you know, growing up in little small town Delavan, I'd never seen a plane up close. I'd never flown, never seen a plane up close. So to be able to sit there and watch these jets take off. I mean, if the winds go in the right direction, they stood at the end of that one runway. I don't know what number runway that is at Mitchell Field, but it's the east-west runway. And if the wind is coming a little bit south, they take off going to the south. Actually, no, it's not the east-west. It's north-south runway. They take off from close to Layton Avenue heading south towards, like, I guess that's College or whatever it is the next one down. Not Ryan Road. Ryan Road's too far. It's College and then, oh, shit, what's the other? Anyway, it doesn't matter. But so they sit at the end of the runway. If the wind, that you land and take off into the wind, if the wind's coming up a little bit from the south, they would be landing into that wind and then taking off the same direction. So right by that little parking area was a great place to sit and watch planes. I would ride my motorcycle down there sometimes and just sit on the motorcycle and watch a few planes land. And it kind of reminded me of the scene in Top Gun where Tom Cruise is on his motorcycle, sitting next to a runway with planes taking off while he's making out with Kelly McGillis. Of course, I wasn't making out with a chick down there at the time. Well, I wonder if I ever did. I don't remember if I ever did take a chick on a motorcycle ride down there. But yeah, I was channeling my inner Tom Cruise there, parked by the airstrip, watching planes take off and land. That was closed after September 11th for security reasons. And then I remember, you know, I was, whether I would take a girl on a date down to Chicago, and then going into the Sears Tower, you had to go through metal detectors. And that was the first, I mean, before September 11th, the only place you ever had to, before September 11th, you didn't go through metal detectors to go into a courthouse. You didn't go through metal detectors to go into really anywhere. And even at the airport, you had metal detectors, and you, but they were set to really weak sensitivities. But you could, anybody could go to the airport and walk all the way down to the gates. You could go all the way to the gates without a ticket. You had, and if you went to the gates, you did have to go through the magnetometers, through the metal detectors. But they were super easy to get through. You throw your change in the little thing and you go through and just boom, boom, they just people right through. You didn't have to take off your shoes or anything like that. But so that was the only place. The airport was the only place you had to go through. The airport was the only place where most people had ever seen metal detectors. But after September 11th, then you started seeing them pop up everywhere. And of course, it was under the guise of, well, we've got to protect against terrorism. But let's be honest. Whether it was, I think it first started with sporting events. I think it first started with things like, and it wasn't even magnetometers at first. It was bag checks at counties. Was it the time? No, it wasn't County Stadium. Yeah, it was. That was still County Stadium. Bag checks at County Stadium. Maybe it was Miller Park. Gosh, when did Miller Park open? No, I think it was Miller Park. 2001. Let me see here. When did Miller Park open? I think Miller Park opened like 2002. Nope, April 6, 2001. So that was. So Miller Park opened in 2001. So yeah, you go to Miller Park and suddenly they do bag checks. You know, they're supposedly looking for explosives, but that was, and you know, it was just because they were tired of people sneaking beer into sporting events. But under the guise of security and terrorism, then suddenly that's where the bag checks. Before September 11th, none of that. If September 11th hadn't happened, think of the places now where I can guarantee wouldn't have, I can't guarantee. It's plausible that this whole, it's not a tradition, this whole habit, this whole, standard, this whole practice, this whole acceptance of bag checks, because now there's bag checks at Summerfest, bag checks at State Fair, bag checks at major sporting events, college and professional. I mean, it's just common practice these days. And if it wasn't for September 11th, that may not be the case. Maybe it would have just taken another 10 years, and maybe by now they still would have, maybe with all the mass, that's probably what it would have been with the mass shootings. They were just looking for a reason to invade your privacy. But remember, before September 11th, that kind of stuff didn't happen. There was more of a respect for people's privacy in their person. And that just all changed after September 11th. And so that's one of the things that I remember is I remember when we were a more free-moving society before the TSA, before all that stuff. And the other thing that always sticks with me is Flight 93. Like Flight 93, the people who were on that flight, you know, reading about their story. I remember early on hearing the story that, and the phrase, let's roll, that's what they said. I mean, we were safer on September 11th at 11 a.m. because even the people on that plane, old Flight 93 over Pennsylvania, they figured out what was going on. Because before that, it was just sit back and enjoy the ride and don't mess with the terrorists, and they'll make their ransom demands and get their, you know, moment in the limelight, and hostages will be released, and then you're good. I mean, that was the protocol before September 11th, was to just, if you were a hostage, shut up and keep your mouth shut, and, you know, everything would be okay. You know, flight, Pan Am flight, whatever that was. I don't remember. But I remember as a kid seeing the planes get hijacked and stuff like that. And they'd always get, they'd be landed, and then, you know, they'd be a big news foo-for-ah. But here Scott says, we've gone through 20 years of conditioning to accept the invasion of privacy. Yeah, we have. And it was ushered in. And again, it probably would have been ushered in by something else. They probably would have used we got Ralph from Pleasant Prairie jumping in tonight too. Ralph, great to have you on the chat. September 11th was the lubrication that they used to shove bag checks and magnetometers up our you-know-whats, and it really ushered it in. Maybe it would have happened anyway. I think it would have taken a lot more time. Maybe it wouldn't have. Maybe we'd still be living in a society where we don't have magnetometers and bag checks everywhere, but, you know, it's hard to say. We don't know what might have happened. And they would, and the way the media is, the way liberals are, they would have probably used mass shootings as an excuse. With, you know, after Columbine, I don't know, Columbine had already happened. Columbine was in the late 90s, I believe. But they would have used something else, some mass shooting, something they would have used to begin that process of taking away people's individual, and you know, and is it a violation of freedom? I mean, look, sporting events is a private thing. I mean, you know, but it just seemed like it was more culturally accepted to invade your private, more culturally accepted to screen you, look in your bags. That's just something that didn't happen prior to September 11th. But, you know, Flight 93, we were safer on September 11th at 11 a.m. The people on that plane, Flight 93, figured it out. And after that, I mean, I think that the whole TSA thing, I mean, that was really all done for now. We didn't need that. Look at Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. He still got on a plane, and when people saw him doing what he was doing, they went into action. And what they do, they, you know, belted him, zip-tied him to a – or duct-taped him to his seat or whatever. I mean, it just – we didn't need all this other stuff. Just the knowledge of what was potentially possible gave us the information. When you've got a plane full of 50 people, 80 people, a terrorist isn't going to make their way in the cockpit. Look, this is what we should have done. Screw the TSA. We should have fortified cockpit doors, locked the cockpit doors, and be aware. Lock the cockpit doors and be aware. You know, that's all we needed to do after September 11th. We didn't need the TSA. We didn't need, you know, these ridiculous screening procedures. Lock the cockpit doors and, you know, maybe do some screening of foreigners in the country. And we would have, you know, we didn't need to do everything we did at airports. But, you know, here we are. 20 years later. So yeah, I reflect on that. You know, listening to Kamala Harris and her speech. So Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, they all decided this year they're going to Shanksville. They're going to go to Shanksville, and not Ground Zero. Not that they're going to Shanksville, not the Pentagon. So this year, Joe Biden didn't speak, probably because it was too early in the day for Joe Biden. He hadn't had his morning nookie yet, his blanket and his bottle, and wasn't capable of speaking in front of a microphone. But Kamala Harris, George W. Bush gave a speech, and you know, I've lost so much respect for George W. Bush. Back when Bush was president, I was a super big Bush fan, between the Patriot Act, other things, and now recently as Bush is, you know. George Bush is clearly just a big establishment Republican. He's Democrat light. He's a Democrat light type of Republican. And Bush never fought back. Bush just took it. He just, you know, oh yeah, it's just politics. he never fought back on behalf of freedom or conservative principles, and even defending himself. He never pushed back against the liberals. He just sat there and he took it. But it's clear now with, you know, and I know the Bush family has a personal vendetta against Trump because Trump was critical of Jeb Bush. What do you call him? He didn't call him Sleepy Joe because that's Sleepy Joe. If he, low energy. I don't remember what his nickname for Jeb Bush was. I lost a lot of respect for George W. Bush, but he's giving a speech at Shanksville. George Bush was this past Saturday. I'm watching this Saturday morning before I went to the gym. And he's given this speech on unity and what we need is unity. And then Kamala Harris speaks after George Bush, and she says that and this liberals love this. I mean, and that's the reason that Bush was given, because George Bush, because the Bush family is anti-Trump. They're never Trumpers. They're now in the fold because what do liberals love? Liberals love promoting a Republican because it's one thing for liberals to hate a Republican, but for a Republican to hate a Republican, well, then that Republican must be really bad. So if, of course, the Clintons aren't going to be fans of Trump, but here, look, even the Bushes, you know, they're Republicans and they don't like Trump. Trump must be really bad. I mean, so that's why Bush was invited to speak. And that's why it got, you know, a lot of TV time. And George W. Bush does a speech on unity. Kamala Harris, she says, you know, in her speech, you know, unity is essential. That's what Kamala Harris said. Unity is essential. And I sat there watching this. And I'm like, you know, what the fuck is unity? What does unity even mean? Unify how? Because they don't say what we need to unify for. Like after September 11th, we were unified that we wanted to, you know, not 100%, but most of the country, Republicans and Democrats, wanted to go bomb the shit out of whoever did that, the Taliban or whoever, Osama bin Laden. They wanted to go after them. We had unity in wanting to go after Osama bin Laden. But when they say unity now, what do they mean? Because they're saying, yeah, we need unity now. We need unity now like we had back then. What does that even mean? Unity. Unify. How do we unify? All falling, because they don't say what they want to unify behind. They just say unity, unity. Well, we know what they mean by we conservatives. We know. It means they want us to fall in line like lemmings and do what the government says. When they say unity, when the liberals say unity, what they really want is obedience. They might as well just say it. They want you to do what they say, live like they want you to live, do what they want you to do. And this is the same group of people who for 4 years, the mantra was resistance, resist, 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 resist. How come when there's a Republican in office, it's resist, resist, resistance is what this country needs. Resistance is patriotic. But all of a sudden, when the Democrats are in charge, unity is what we need. Oh, no, unity. We got to have unity, unity, unity. It's so fucking phony. And you know, I'm preaching to the choir. You guys get it. And here's the thing. I think everybody gets it. The media would act like they're trying to gaslight us and make us think that what – because if you don't hear, look, on social media, you speak out, you get squashed, they squash dissent, they squash any notion. So it's to make you feel like you're alone, to make you feel like you're the crazy one, to make you feel like you're the only one that feels the way you feel, so that you feel isolated. And when you feel isolated, you feel like, well, you question yourself. But yeah, this whole unity business, you know, again, it's so phony, and most of the country gets it, but the media sits here and tries to continue to perpetuate their narrative and for 4 years talk about resistance and how great it is to resist and question elections and suspect that our elections were tampered with. And then all of a sudden, nope, when the tables are turned, nope, the securest elections ever, resistance is if you resist, you're a domestic terrorist, you know, you can burn down cities and burn down police stations, and that's just letting your voice be heard. Protesting, rioting is the voice of the unheard. That's what they said. Rioting is the voice of the unheard. But then now, walk into the Capitol building, and that's insurrection, and that's treasonous, and you know, go to jail in D.C. for solitary confinement just for walking in the Capitol and taking pictures on January 6th. Forget the fact that here in Wisconsin, we had Democrats busting through windows to get into the Capitol building back during Act 10's passage. But here's the thing. Freedom is the only thing that politically you can give everyone. You can't give everyone $1 million. This whole unity thing, you can't – unity – again, for the Democrats means obedience. There is no unity that works for everybody. And that's what's so phony about it. Unity would mean shut up and take the vaccine because the government told you. Unity would mean shut up and wear a mask for the rest of your fucking life because the government told you to. That's what unity means right now. Unity means don't question when your governor shuts your business down and runs you out of business. That's what they mean by unity, unity. Unity means shut up and obey. That's what it means. But freedom is the only thing politically that you can give everyone. You can't give everyone $1 million. You'd have to take some money from some people, tax the rich to give it to someone else. You can't give everyone what they want. you'd have to pick winners and losers. You can't force masking and give everyone something. You can't implement a mask mandate and give everyone something. You're giving one person, one group, the pro-mask folks, what they want, and then the people that don't, you're taking. The only thing that you can give everyone, freedom is like love. Love, you can give, and you have an endless supply of love to give if you choose to. Freedom is like that. Freedom is the only thing that you can give and give and give and give. You can give people freedom. You can give it to everyone. You can give a Republican freedom, and you can give a Democrat freedom. You can give them both something. You can give everyone the freedom to make the decisions that are right for them. There's 350 some million people, 360. There's over 350 million people in this country. It would be impossible to have to do right by even half of them. It's not even the case where one policy is right for half the country and wrong for others. You're lucky if a policy might be right for 10%. Because everybody has a different circumstance. Every individual has a different circumstance. Every individual has, you know, what there's, you know, even tax policy. Tax policy doesn't benefit half the country and then disbenefit, penalize the other half. Maybe for like 10%, the tax policy, the way it is, it's just right for 10% of the people. But then everybody else is, you know, it's not exactly right for them. Someone else would be better with a little different tax policy. Freedom is the only thing that you can give people. Because it allows those 350 million people to make 350 million different decisions, because every decision is a little bit different. Where to put their retirement money, whether to buy health insurance or not, all those little things. Freedom to choose is the only thing you can give everyone, and it's the only way to make sure that everyone gets the best outcome for them, because the government can't make a choice for 350 million people, because there is no one choice. Everybody's right thing is slightly different. So you have to let them go out and make that choice and buy the things they want and have the resources of the money that they earn to do it. Because again, 350 million people, there's 350 million different variations and permutations of what is the right thing for them. It's not right to mandate the vaccine, and it's not right to ban the vaccine. But that's my next point, is it's important to understand the false positioning of the sides of these debates. Because only one side of the COVID debate has the moral high ground. No one wants to ban masks. So to portray the mask mandate as a moral equivalence, you know, there's those who want a mask mandate and those who do not, that's not a good dichotomy. The opposite of a mask mandate is not no mask mandate. The opposite of a mask mandate is a mask ban. Nobody is asking us to ban masks. Nobody is asking to ban masks, not from schools, not from businesses, not from anywhere. No one has proposed a mask ban. The only ban that we proposed is we proposed a ban of mandates, but no one is proposing to ban masks. You can wear a fucking mask. You can wear two masks. You can wear three masks. Wrap your head in saran wrap if you want, if you think that keeps you safer. Buy a charcoal filter, UV something. Do whatever. No one is asking for masks to be banned. Those of us who don't support the communist space diaper of obedience, we're simply saying we want the choice not to wear one. You're welcome to wear one. Your kids are welcome to wear a mask in school. You're welcome to wear a mask in the grocery store. What we're seeing right now is nobody wants to. I got a great story. Last week we went to, let me make one more point real quick. Same thing with guns. The inverse of gun bans, it would be a gun requirement. I've told this story before, I'm going to tell it again. I was at my gym and some guy, he saw me on TV for a Wisconsin Carry interview with local news before local news banned me as well. And he said, you know, I don't think people should be allowed to own guns. You know, I know you think that we should, but, you know, I hope you respect my opinion. And I said, I don't respect your opinion because your opinion isn't just. I don't want you to have to buy a gun. I don't want you to be forced to own a gun. You're free to make the choice that's right for you. And I would respect your choice not to buy a gun. I respect you. If you don't want to own a gun, don't fucking buy one. I respect that choice. What I don't respect is you. If you said, well, if he just said to me, well, I don't want to own a gun, I'd say, okay, well, I respect your decision. I think it's foolish, but maybe it is right for you. Maybe you have such a bad temper that you couldn't control yourself. Maybe you're, you know, get so depressed every night that you might blow your head off if you had a gun nearby. And the only reason you don't is because, you know, stabbing yourself in the wrists or hanging yourself seems too barbaric and you can't do it. But if you had a gun, you could pull the trigger. Maybe for you, not having a gun is the right choice. Maybe your wife hates you and she wants to blow your brains out when you're sleeping at night, and having a gun in the house would be a really bad idea. Fine. I'm not asking. I respect your decision not to own a gun. I do not respect your belief that I shouldn't be able to own a gun. You don't want to own a gun? I respect that. You don't want me to own, you want me to respect your not wanting me to, you want me to respect your position that doesn't respect my decisions. That's pretty fucked up. So, you know, no, I don't respect that. The opposite of a gun ban, there is no moral equivalence. Here's people that want to be allowed to own guns and here's people that want to ban guns. Those aren't two co-equal moral equivalent positions. The people that want to own guns, they don't want to force anybody else to own a gun. If you wanted to force, same thing with us who don't want vaccine mandates. We don't want the vaccine banned. We just don't want it mandated. And this is why freedom always loses, because the debate is never between banning vaccines and mandating vaccines. The debate is always between the freedom to choose or forcing vaccines. Well, then any little tiny bit of compromise takes you closer to the position of those that want to mandate. In the debate of guns, between being able to own a gun and not being able to own a gun, the polar position would be gun mandates. You have to own a gun, because you can compromise from having to own a gun. Okay, so you don't. So you only have to own a gun if you live by yourself in the country and the police department is more than 10 minutes away. Then you have to own a gun. Because then you can compromise a little bit on that gun mandate and still have freedom somewhere to choose in the middle. But that's the problem with all these debates, is it's the debate is never between two truly opposite sides of the spectrum. The debate is always, look, here's the people that want the freedom to choose. They don't want to force anybody. I'm trying to think of an example where, I guess abortion's the only good one. Because with abortion, there's the people that want to ban abortions and the people that want to have abortions. The people that want to have abortions don't want to force anybody else to have an abortion. They just want the freedom to choose to have an abortion. The people that don't want to have an abortion don't have to have an abortion, but then there are people that want to ban abortion. So that's the only part of the political debate on the conservative side of the aisle where there's truly that opposite position. And don't, you know, pro-life people, don't sit here and attack me because I'm portraying your position as somehow, I'm not making an opinion on, you know, I could talk about my feelings on abortion in another show. We don't have time here tonight, but you know, that's, we talk about unity and all this bullshit, and there is no unity, because what they really want is obedience. You cannot have unity and have freedom. You can't have it unless the only thing you want to unify behind is freedom. But all the other things they're talking about is, you know, whether it's vaccine, masks, whatever, there is no unity to be had there. Next thing I want to talk about tonight, this is, you know, as we reflect on September 11th, this has just come across my radar screen here in the past couple weeks. I always knew growing up that my grandfather was in the Army, but I didn't know. So like when we were younger, my mom always said, I only met my grandfather once. My mother always told us that, that my grandfather was a German, that we were German. So, you know, you say, well, hey, what are we? Mom's like, well, we're German. My grandfather was a Schneider. On my maternal side, my great grandmother was a Heidenreich. Actually, that's what my maternal. So my maternal grandmother was a Heidenreich, was her last name. And my maternal grandfather was a Schneider. My mom's maiden name was Schneider. John Schneider married Laverne Heidenreich. And then they had my mom. Her name's Barb. So I knew we were German. I knew we were German. And then I also knew that my grandfather was in the Army. But as a young child, I only met my grandfather once, on my mother's side once. We went down to Missouri to visit him. I always thought, well, if he's German and he fought in World War II, like he must have been in the German Army. Like I had this misconception, and I guess I just never brought it up to my mom. So growing up, when people talked about, did you have a relative that was a veteran? I mean, I never said that my grandfather was a veteran or anything. I just, because I didn't know if he was in the German Army. I didn't know if he was a Nazi. I knew my grandfather was in World War II, but we were German. So I thought, okay, World War II, he's German. Germans were the enemy. This might be where, like, I always felt like I was inferior when I was a kid, but plus we were, you know, we were poor. We didn't have a lot of money. And my mom was in the FDC. My mom was divorced, didn't have a dad around when other kids did, you know, school events, whatever. I always felt inferior when I was a kid. I just always did. I just remember just wanting to be normal, wished I was normal. But so anyway, this probably added to it. I thought, okay, my grandfather was in the war, but we were German. He was German. So he must've been on the enemy side of the war. I mean, you know, I never talked about it. Well, it turns out that my grandfather was an American soldier. He was in the Army. And recently, my mother has come across my grandfather's, my Grandpa Schneider's war medals. Some relative had them, and I have three aunts, and I guess they've been distributed. His war medals were distributed to my aunts and my mother. One of his war medals, my grandfather, well, I'll tell this in a minute. So this has all come about recently. My mom started asking some questions about my grandfather's service. She asked these of my grandfather's second wife's family, who knew my grandfather better than I did, in some cases better than my mother did, I think. Because my grandfather and grandmother divorced, on my mother's side, divorced when my mom was very young. Same thing with my parents. But so recently, there's a letter that my grandfather, his name was John Schneider, Jack Schneider, I called him John Faulkner Schneider. He wrote to my grandmother, and this letter is dated December 30th, 1944. I'm looking at this. So they've still got these letters. It was scanned and a picture was sent to my mother and she shared it with me. And I just thought it'd be cool to read for you guys, because it's just reading this is exactly, I mean, it's, this is, again, so the letter is somewhere, it's December 30th, 1944, and this is how it's written. This is on the Well-Armed Radio MeWe page, if you want to go see it. But it's December 30th, 1944, somewhere in Germany. That's what's typed here. And this is where, I'm going to read it to you guys. My darling wife, and this is on the, like, just like you picture it, old, aged-looking paper, with a typewriter that you can tell is like a, you know, early stage typewriter. Having been beaten by Eric, spelled E-R-I-C-H, in two games of chess, I feel qualified to do a little beating of my own on the typewriter. At least this is why I can't lose. At least this way I can't lose. So here goes another letter to my little honey. This is from my grandfather to my grandmother. Something should be done about lengthening a letter. It must be quite horrible for you to receive letters from me all the time and have me say just about the same thing in it every time. There is one solution, and that is to devote a specific incident to each letter, or rather, a letter to each specific incident. I think that I could make them interesting enough to break the monotony, give you an idea of what war is like, and still not violate any censorship rules. That's really interesting, interject here, that my grandfather had to be careful. Here he put in this letter somewhere in Germany. He couldn't even say where he was in Germany on December 30th, 1944. Back to his letter. I could give you an idea of what war is like and still not violate any censorship rules. I believe that a good place to start would be with the invasion. Although I have given you folks back home a few hints, if it is now permitted to write more or it is now permitted to write more or less in detail. As I have said before, the newspapers and magazines tried their best to give the people a good idea, yet the English language, or any other language for that matter, is inadequate to record those things and thoughts which race through one's mind while lying under intense enemy fire. On the next page, I shall try to give a description of the thoughts which I was thinking on June 6, 1944. I am not bragging when I write this, because of all the men on that beach, I had the least to brag about. It dawned as a dreary, dull day with a fine drizzle descending from fairly high clouds. The dark of night reluctantly was giving way to the advancing daylight when the LCT on which I had been a passenger for the past 5 days was first sighted the shores of France. Only once before, now interject here again, I'm just reading this letter for the first time like a week, 2 weeks ago when my mom got it. And this was fascinating to me because I didn't know what my grandfather did in the war. I didn't know that he was on the American side till, you know, very recently. This was just, and then here I am. I've heard about D-Day. I read about D-Day. This is my grandfather in his own words telling the story of D-Day. Mind blown. I mean, I've loved the movie Saving Private Ryan. I mean, just seeing what those soldiers really went through. And then all of a sudden, here's my own grandfather telling me this story that I've seen on the news, the story that I've seen in documentaries. And here's my grandfather's own words that I've never read before because I'd never seen this letter before in my life until 2 weeks ago. It just riveted me. So I'm going to go back to the story, back to his letter. It dawned as a dreary, dull day with a fine drizzle descending from the advancing, descending from fairly high clouds. The dark of night reluctantly was giving way to advancing daylight when the LCT on which I had been a passenger for the last 5 days first sighted the shores of France. Only once before had I ever seen the French shore, and that was at Cherbourg in 1936 when the world was still at peace. Now I turned my face towards the still dark shore and could see the very faintest outline. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, and although the other men were still sleeping, with the sole exception of those who were preparing their vehicles, I did not want to miss the first glimpse of the shore which we were to take and on which we were to make history. But I soon found that I was almost impossible to make out any landmarks because the night had not yet removed its veil. Only occasionally could I see a tiny portion of the silhouetted coast as a bomb landed, and we hoped we would be what we hoped would be an enemy installation. In the red glow which lit up the scenery for a split second, I could distinguish a hilltop and mentally compare it with the maps I had seen, but such a small portion did not register as familiar in my brain as far as knowing where I was in the dark. A fairly high sea slapped the sides of our LCT. I don't know what LCT stands for. Something combat transport, you know, I don't know what the L, something LCT, something combat transport. And the spray infiltrated through my inadequate field jacket. I soon was shivering with the cold. An LCT is a ship equipped to land tanks and vehicles once it has rammed its nose on the beach. The bow consists of a square plate, which can be lowered by means of a winch and acts as a ramp over which the vehicles drive to the sand. The deck of one of these ships is a FLA, is a flat, I know there's something, a flat platform on which the vehicles rest. There is no overhead protection to keep the spray from the crew and other personnel. Hence, I was being soaked as the spray whipped by a fresh wind was flung into my face. Slowly as the light of day crowded the black of night away, hang on 1 sec here, I got to go to the next letter here. Sorry, should have had these lined up. I took stock of what was floating around our ship. Hundreds, oh, here on the chat, landing craft tank. Thanks, Scott. I appreciate landing craft tank. Awesome. That's what LCT is, landing craft tank. I took stock of what was floating around our ship. Hundreds of other LCTs. Well, I should have read his letter again. Here he says, landing craft, comma, tank. LCIs, landing craft infantry, and a curious conglomeration of other vessels crowded the English Channel. All seemed to be headed for one spot. Turning toward the land once more, I could now see the coastline a little clearer. Had our Air Force destroyed the pillboxes as we were promised it would? The cliffs did not look as if they would welcome us with open arms. Slowly the hours ticked by. It became daylight and the rain clouds blew away. Only then did I realize how ominous the French coast looked. If our Air Force had not done their job well, we would have a tough time getting a foothold. By 6 o'clock, we had approached the land to within 2 miles. By 6:30 a.m., the first boatload of infantry had set foot on French soil. My LCT lay 2 miles offshore, and I had a grandstand seat of the invasion. But let us see what was going on at the time that our infantry hit the beach. As the first load was set on shore, they were met with machine gun fire from the cliffs. Soon more boats had disgorged their human cargoes. A few tanks had succeeded in landing, but were soon knocked out by artillery fire. No heavy weapons worth speaking of were there to answer the withering fire of the Nazi guns, machine guns, mortars, and small arms, which raked the doughboys on that beach. It was impossible to move from the sandy stretch. At this time, our beachhead consisted of seven yards of shale, which was a very shallow bottom made by the outgoing tide. What would happen when the tide began coming in again? Meanwhile, it had become 8:15 a.m. At this time, our boys on the beach were supposed to have taken their first objective, which was the cliff. Regimental headquarters was to have landed this time too, but when regimental headquarters landed, they were met with whistling bullets and mortar shells. The boys who had landed at 6:30 a.m. still lay on the beach, helplessly pinned to the sand. Thousands of men lay side by side. One never knew whether their neighbor was dead or alive. No one bothered to look, but dead were there aplenty. Already the tide was returning and tugging at the wounded, dragging many of them out to sea where they drowned. At the end of the beachhead were two Sherman tanks mounting 75-millimeter guns. They had been abandoned by their crews and now served as shelter for the wounded who had crawled underneath and behind them. An officer shouted for volunteers who knew how to shoot a 75-millimeter gun. A few raised hands, and the lieutenant explained what he wanted done. Under heavy fire, four infantry Joes climbed into the tanks, examined the guns, and, upon finding them still intact, began firing at the machine gun nests and other enemy emplacements. Meanwhile, the regimental commander had landed, surveyed the situation, and said to the boys, "We might as well die on top of the cliff as here. Let's go." And he led the men from the beach. Many men died in the minefields. Many others died from enemy fire while they marched or crawled from that hell. Once they had gained the shelter of the cliff, the men were fairly safe in comparison with what they had been through during the last few hours. The details of all this were lost to me. I heard about it from, hang on, I got to get to the next letter here, the men who were there, but I had my share of sweating when evening came around. Towards 6 o'clock p.m., our boat skipper tried to land us on shore as we moved toward the dry land. A hail of artillery fire and mortar shells, not to mention small arms fire, was directed towards us. Our boat made a fairly large target, and it seemed that the enemy could not help but hit our scow. Next to us, a small landing craft hit a mine, was blown sky high, scattering dead and wounded into the water. Bodies floated. Suddenly, we thought our hour had struck. Under our deck, we heard a scraping noise. Was it a mine? Was it an underwater obstacle, which was... Sorry. Was it a mine? Was it an underwater obstacle, which was mined? Or was it only a sunken vehicle? No matter what it was, we stood a good chance of having our propellers damaged or being hung up on whatever it was. No one dared breathe until we had passed it. Then everyone exhaled at once. By now, shells were dropping perilously close to our craft. An LCI 20 yards to our left was hit, and exploding ammunition added to the din and danger. Everyone was careful to keep his head below the side of the craft. When we finally reached the shore and the ramp was lowered, we found that it was impossible to drive the vehicles off at that spot. We could do nothing else but back off again. Once more, we had to pass the ICI with its exploding cargo of ammunition. Once more, floating bodies being carried out to sea by the tide. And once more, we waited for the craft to run on a mine, but we reached our anchorage without any mishap. So I'm going to just pause right there. I sit there and I read this and I think, man, if my grandfather was 20 yards to the left or 20 yards to the right, I wouldn't be sitting here reading this. But for 20 yards distance, I wouldn't be here. My mom wouldn't be here. You know, my grandfather would have died on the beaches of Normandy, and there would be no Nick Clark. There would be no, you know, Barb Schneider, my mom. Anyway, back to the letter. Night came and with it the Luftwaffe. A long day, we had waited for the first German plane to make its appearance, but Jerry did not show up. But as soon as dark fell, he sent a few planes over, and of all the boats to pick on, he had to pick on mine. I happened to be in the galley, the ship's kitchen, drawing a cup of coffee when he dropped a string of 5 bombs so close to us that our LCT danced a quite respectable jig to the roar of the explosion. Our anti-aircraft defenses made a terrific din, which was enlarged by the fact that I was between 4 iron walls with the anti-aircraft guns immediately above me. But even that night went past us without further incident, and we were landed the next day shortly after noon. Even at that time, the beach was still subjected to artillery fire and mortar fire, and we went several uneasy moments before we were at the top of the cliff. By 3 o'clock, I was removing the waterproofing from the motor and thinking that the worst part was over when I heard the report of a rifle and felt the breeze of a bullet as it whined past my head. I had forgotten about the snipers, which we had all been told would be lurking here and there. Well, he had missed me that time, and I had no intentions of giving him a second chance. When he was caught, it was a French girl who had been working with the Germans. The true story will probably never be known, since dead French girls tell no tales. By 6 p.m., I had joined the rest of the team, who were beginning to have their doubts about ever seeing me again, and that is the story of the invasion. I have left a few things out since they would not pass the censor, but I shall tell you when I get home again. The other day, I finally received my official citation for the Bronze Star. To satisfy you and mother, I shall quote it for you. It reads, "For heroic achievement in connection with military operations against the enemy in the vicinity of Colville-sur-Mer, Normandy, France, June 6, 1944. Voluntarily leaving a position of safety, Sergeant..." Hang on, I got to get to the next letter here. "Sergeant Schneider courageously made..." I think it was Staff Sergeant. "Courageously made repeated trips across terrain covered by heavy artillery, mortar, and small arms fire to assist in evacuating wounded men. Sergeant Schneider's unfaltering bravery and decisive action resulted in saving many lives. Now you know it, and I hope you are satisfied." And then there's a cutout from the article, The LaGrange Citizen, from January 25th, 1945. It reads, "In a letter received this week from Staff Sergeant John F. Schneider by his wife, Laverne Heidenreich Schneider, in Western Springs, he quoted the official citation which accompanied his Bronze Star. It read," and then I read the same thing that I just read to you, "He is the son of Marjorie Schneider, South Brainerd Avenue near Joliet Road. News that he has been awarded the Bronze Star was reported just last week, along with the information that he had been transferred to the same unit in which Private First Class Kenneth Kading is assigned." And there's a picture of my grandfather, John Schneider, and his GI photo. So that's the letter that I just got. My grandfather drove a Jeep onto the beach under heavy fire and pulled wounded soldiers off. That's the part that was left out by the censors. He pulled wounded soldiers off the beach with his – he was assigned to drive a Jeep. When he got to shore, he got the Jeep off. He took the waterproofing off of the Jeep, out of the motor, whatever you do to waterproof a motor for a Jeep being on an amphibious landing. drove it onto the beach, picked up the wounded soldiers and dragged them to, drove them to safety multiple times. And for that, he was awarded the Bronze Star. So I never knew it. I mean, all these years, I mean, I wish I'd have known. I mean, it's not my mom's fault. She didn't know. I mean, I only met my grandfather once. I was, five. So I was very young. You're not going to sit there and talk about war stories. I mean, maybe some do. I mean, I think if you'd had time to spend with your grandfather, but but yeah, that's, so I all these years, I mean, I wish, I think about if had I known all these Memorial Days, it would have been so much more personal. And it is, I'm a sentimental person as it is. I mean, on Memorial Day, I don't sit there and think, oh, it was no one I knew. You know, I didn't know. I mean, I've always felt, you know, freedom is very important to me. And I've always felt that strong sense of introspection on Memorial Day and the sacrifices that soldiers made for us, but for freedom. But it would have been even more so had I known that my grandfather he was the second wave of the Normandy invasion, scheduled to land at like 8 that morning or noon or whatever. And then they couldn't, they had to pull back off and anchor for offshore till the next day. So he landed the second day, which I don't think the beach was secured for several days. I think it was, I don't remember how long it took to secure the beaches of Normandy, France, but anyway. So yeah, my grandfather was awarded a Bronze Star for bravery, for valor. And I never knew it. So I feel a little guilty that I never knew. Memorial Day and Veterans Day is going to take on a little different meaning this year. And again, it's not that I ever blew it off. I didn't, but it just is something that really jumps out to me. And there's a little bit more to this story that's going to be told, but I can't tell it to you now. But hopefully in the next month or two, as I work through a couple angles, there's more to that story that'll be told, hopefully. And if it will, I'll share it. Last thing I want to talk about tonight is Rebecca Clefish. Now she's running for governor. Rebecca Clefish is just as establishment gets. We all knew she was running. She's been hinting at running. Everybody's known that Becky Clefish is running. Rebecca Clefish running is the reason why the Republican Party of Wisconsin would not participate or help with the Governor Evers recall, which fell slightly short last fall. That was total bullshit. I mean, I really wish that the Republican Party would have, if the Republican Party would have gotten online, I honestly believe that we could have Tony Evers out of office right now. I believe that. I believe he would have been recalled. I believe with the help of the Republican Party, we could have gotten it done. But Rebecca Clefish wasn't ready. She wasn't, hadn't been doing her fundraising, wasn't in her position. So for that reason, because Becky Homecki wasn't ready to run, prepared to run in a recall election. A recall election would have left all these other people on solid or on similar ground, whether it was Eric Hovde or whoever else might have jumped in for that recall election against Governor Skeletor. And so the Republican Party wouldn't get online with the recall. The recall fell some signatures short or was turned in late, or I forget what it was, but it fell signatures short. And here we are with the traditional time frame for the governor's race. So Rebecca Clefish has announced she's running. Again, Rebecca Clefish is as establishment gets. Anybody who thinks, look, she spent years as Scott Walker's understudy. And if anybody thinks that after serving as Scott Walker's understudy for 8 years of his first two terms, that's where all her support comes from. Rebecca Clefish's support comes from the Republican Party. She is a party gal. And the notion or the idea that Becca Clefish, who gets all of her support from the party, is going to turn around and buck that party. I mean, she is totally beholden to the establishment. We all know how Scott Walker threw constitutional carry under the bus and backed over it a couple times back during Act 10. We all know how Scott Walker blocks school grounds carry over and over again since 2013 on. Scott Walker goes on the news and says, "I like the law the way it is," when he was asked about school grounds carry. You'd have to be a fool or completely unobservant about politics to know that Rebecca Clefish, she's just beholden to the establishment and the party insiders. She has been an insider for decades. She owes all of her political success to Scott Walker. Rebecca Clefish isn't going to buck the establishment. And bucking the establishment is what we need to actually get anything substantive for gun rights done here in Wisconsin and in Madison. Because Robin Voss isn't going to be the champion for our gun rights. And Devin LeMahieu isn't going to be the champion for our gun rights. Our only hope to get substantive gun rights passed here in Wisconsin, school grounds carry, constitutional carry, is for an outsider who is not beholden to the party establishment. Because if we don't, Robin Voss and Devin LeMahieu will run blocking just like Scott Fitzgerald and Robin Voss ran blocking for Scott Walker. Scott Walker told Scott Fitzgerald, "We don't need this," when it was the school grounds carry bill, Senate bill, was it Senate Bill 169 or something? Scott Walker told Scott Fitzgerald, "We don't need this." And so Senate Bill 169 or whatever it was a few years ago, the constitutional carry, school grounds carry bill, never got a vote. Passed out of committee, never got a vote. A Republican-controlled Senate, Republican-controlled Assembly, a pro-gun bill with Scott Walker as governor. Never got a vote. Never got a vote in the Senate. Never got a vote in the Assembly. Never got to Walker's desk. Walker made damn sure that that bill would never get to his desk by telling Scott Fitzgerald, "We don't need this." And now we sit here trying to push through gun bills with a Democrat governor who's for sure going to veto them. And we had a Republican Senate, Republican Assembly, Republican governor. We couldn't get a fucking thing through. And Rebecca Clefish was lieutenant governor at the time. If you think that putting Becky Clefish in the governor's office is going to be a great day for gun rights in Wisconsin, I want to know what kind of medical marijuana you're smoking. Because she's as establishment gets. She's been a part of the establishment for decades in Wisconsin. She was part of Scott Walker's administration. She was the lieutenant governor. When every substantive gun bill out there got slammed and kicked to the curb, by Republicans, not by Democrats, by Republicans. So what else is out there? Kevin Nicholson, I think it was a targeted robocall. I think this is public knowledge, and it is public knowledge, because if Ron Johnson does not run for reelection, Kevin Nicholson is going to run for the Senate. If Ron Johnson runs for re-election, then Kevin Nicholson is going to run for governor. That was right out of Kevin Nicholson's mouth. So so Kevin Nicholson will be running. Kevin Nicholson will have the backing of the U-Lines, who funded a good portion of his Senate campaign. He'll have a lot of money behind him. And at this point, Nicholson would have my support. I would support Kevin Nicholson every day of the week over Rebecca Clefish. There's a couple other has-beens or B-side, B-candidates running. Joan Beglinger. I really like her positions. You know, if you want to check it out, look up beglingerforgovernor.com. It's B-E-G, like Beglinger for governor. Beg and linger. beglingerforgovernor.com/views. You know, her positions, I mean, it's very, her First Amendment is under siege. Elections, they need sound processes, incredible outcomes. We need equality, not equity. Our greatest COVID threat isn't dying. The media has an ethics problem. I mean, I like all of her positions, but in my opinion, it's just not enough for governor. Healthcare isn't much of a free market. Let me talk about this guy first. John Wichman, who has been running for governor now for a year and a half or something. You guys may have heard of him. He's been made the rounds on Wisconsin Carry's Facebook group. He was in there. Someone on MeWe made the comment to me, "I know you've been critical of John Wichman, but I think he's a great guy and pro Second Amendment." Here's the thing. being a great guy and being pro-Second Amendment doesn't make someone qualified to be a governor or a capable governor. You know, it takes the ability to be an executive to be the governor. If you can run something, if you can't run something big, you can't be governor. You're just going to get rolled. A good and principled person, they could be a legislator, because legislators, they don't have a cabinet. Legislators don't have to staff a big administration. Legislators don't have to appoint hundreds, perhaps thousands of people to positions all over the state of Wisconsin in these government bureaucracies and get those people to follow your lead. And see, that's the difference between being an executive and being a legislator. Jonathan Wichman, he's just a wannabe. I mean, and it's not enough. Even if Jonathan Wichman's a great guy, even if he's pro-Second Amendment, even if he's committed and principled as hell, even if he would never waver for his principles, that's not enough. You have to have a network of people who you can lead and who you can trust to build an administration, to head up these departments of all these different agencies of the state. And Wichman not only has none of that experience, he hasn't done anything in his life to indicate that he's capable of operating anything of scale. Trump had a ton of experience running a massive organization. And look at how much Trump, even Donald Trump, had in the first 2 years of his presidency, getting good people in place in his administration and in his cabinet and at the department levels to win. It's not enough because when you're the governor or the president, you have all these, and again, at the federal level, it's a much larger scale, but even at the governor, you have the, you know, all these different agencies. You have the Department of Health and Human Services. You have the DNR. You have, I mean, just all these different Department of Families, Children and Family. You just have all these different agencies. You have WEDA, Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. You've got the the big money conduit, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, WEDC, which is, they call it corporation. It's a government agency. It's a bullshit way to, this is how through government you can give political payback in terms of millions and millions of dollars of tax credits to all your donors, the WEDC. You've got all these, you have to have a network of people. How do you get that network of people? Well, example, if you run a big corporation, if you're the CEO of a corporation, you've got all these people who worked for you, reported to you, you know how to scale something up. You know how to delegate. You know how to vet people and get people in to head up. Because as the CEO of a company, you can't manage the sales force and manage the janitorial staff and manage the HR people and manage too much to do in a day. You have to have people under you who will follow your principled goals and desires and implement that throughout the organization. And the state of Wisconsin is one of the biggest organization in the state. I've only got a minute and 45 seconds left here in the live show, so I'm going to run a little bit over time today probably, but thank you guys for tuning in live. Great to have you with Scott and Lon and Ralph from Pleasant Prairie. Good to have some live listeners back in addition to my people that listen throughout the week on the podcast. You guys have a great week and carry on. So like I said, about a minute and a half here before I lose my live feed. But so Wichman just has none of that. Has he managed a very large organization? No. I mean, Wichman doesn't have the leadership background. A small business owner who's never built anything to scale. Look, owning a small business is great. And I respect people who own small businesses. It's hard to run a small business, but it's way different. I mean, I run a small business. It's a small S corp. So, I mean, it's not like a sole proprietorship or anything, but I think Wichman just has a little sole proprietorship, but you have to learning to scale a business, to grow a business beyond what you can do all yourself. Because when you're in a small business, you're kind of like doing it all yourself. You have your hands in everything. You have your hands in the sales. You have your hands in the billing. You have your hands in the accounting. You have your hands in everything. You have your hands in HR. But as your business grows, you can't keep your hands in everything. You have to learn to scale. You have to learn to delegate. You have to learn to get good people and learn to lead. And you don't do that as a small business owner. You do it. And if you do learn to lead, then you scale your business and your business grows and you go from being a five-person business to a 500-person business. And throughout that process, you have learned how to scale. You've learned how to vet people and get people in places to carry out your mission, to carry out your goals, your initiatives. Until you scale to something big, you haven't proven that you can do that. John Wichman hasn't proven that he can scale to something big and run an organization. The state of Wisconsin would be like the biggest, in terms of number of employees, probably the biggest company in the state. And all he's done is run a small business. Again, it's not a knock on small business owners. It's to say the arrogance of people, the ignorance of people to think that just being a principled person, look, I'm principled as fuck. I don't waver from my principles. I'm regimented as hell. I put freedom first in my personal life, in my political action, and what I put my money where my mouth is. I stand by my principles, but I'm not arrogant enough to think that. I actually think I probably could, because with Wisconsin Carry, I think I've met enough people. I honestly think I could be a governor, a good governor, a great governor. But I haven't proven that. I mean, I think that, but I haven't proven that to anybody. I haven't, I mean, my own company, I do extremely well with my company, extremely well. I mean, I make a lot of money, crazy amount of money, but I still haven't scaled my company up to something really, really big. And it's, you know, I'm making a ton of money, but I'm doing it all. I mean, I've got, you know, there's 5 employees with my company. We do really, really, really well, but I haven't scaled to like a 20 or 30 or 100 person company. And that's what becomes hard. So do I think with Wisconsin Carry, do I think that all the people I've met, the legislators who I know the principal, the ones from the non, do I think I could staff an administration? Yeah, I could. But do I think that I've proven that? Maybe. I think I have better qualifications for governor than John Wichman. Because with Wisconsin Carry and all the people that I've met and all the partnerships, I think I could. I think I could put – I know who the Freedom Principle people are. I know enough people in government who know government who are still principled enough. I think I could staff up an administration. But, you know, could I demonstrate that to the state of Wisconsin? Probably not. So, I mean, I wouldn't run for governor. I don't have the audacity to run for governor. You know, do I think I could do it? Yeah. But do I think I could do a good job? Yeah. But do I think that I could demonstrate that to people to prove them? Nah, I probably couldn't. Had I scaled up a company, then that would be something that I could say, look, I did it. Do I think that with Wisconsin Carrying, there's nothing? I don't know. I don't know if it's enough to prove to people. But nothing I've seen from John Wichman tells me that he could scale up. Nothing that I've seen from John Wichman tells me he has the qualifications to staff an administration and get an organization going at the state of Wisconsin from the governor's office and all the that lords over. So that takes me back to Joan Baglinger. Again, seems like a great gal. I really like her position statements, and she has executive experience. She was like, a executive VP level in a healthcare organization. But again, I still don't think it's enough for governor. Healthcare isn't much of a free market. And I think healthcare, it's a different skill set of navigating bureaucracy and regulations and just the fuckery of health insurance and entitlements. You know, healthcare, you're dealing so much with entitlements and health insurance. I don't think you're immersed in the capitalism of free will working in the healthcare industry. It's living in the capitalism of freedom and free markets and free enterprise. You have to learn to give people what they want, and you have to learn to recognize demand and not achieving things utilizing dictate. And so I just don't think that Joan Baglinger, I think she'd get rolled. I don't think she has the network, the executive skill set to staff up an organization. Now, so let me take that same standard and apply it to Kevin Nicholson. First off, Do I think Rebecca Clefish could staff an administration? Absolutely. Absolutely she could. And she'd staff it with all the deep state party insider people that, you know, party ass kiss and people shows. It just, that's who it would be. The Clefish administration would be swamp central. It'd be all the big government Republicans that from Madison who, you know, that's who it would be. Kevin Nicholson, that standard that I talked about being able to scale and staff something big. First off, do I think Nicholson has that experience, the leadership experience? I do. I think from in the military, he led people. He led people into battle. He's got a network of people. And this is hard to explain to people because some people don't know what – in the management consulting world, it's a very – cutthroat isn't the word. It's a very – you got to be good. He worked for McKinsey. I think he still works for McKinsey. No, he worked for McKinsey and then went to work for someone else. But in that management consulting world, you have to be – it's like being a superstar lawyer. You got to be really freaking good to command the cases and the clients that superstar lawyers can land. To be a management consultant, to be in management consulting – You work with some of the people at the highest levels of large organizations, Fortune 500 companies. It's just do I think Kevin Nicholson has the leadership ability and the network and the proven ability to manage and to scale? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I think that he does. He's serves as the volunteer CEO of the No Better Friend Corporation, which he has a staff of people that work under that. I don't want to share some things that I know. Yeah, is that fair to share? That's fair to share. That's public knowledge. Kevin Nicholson, look, Dick and Liz Uline, they own Uline. If you drive down to Kenosha or down to Chicago, past Kenosha, past Pleasant Prairie, you see those big buildings with the, say, Uline on the side. That Dick and Liz Uline, they own that company. Now, they don't. Their last name is spelled like U-I-E-H-L-E-I-N, but the company, they just put U-Line. It sounds the same. It's spelled differently. Billionaires, I'm pretty sure the Ulines are billionaires. They live in Illinois, but their company exists here in Wisconsin. Their company is based in Wisconsin, and they own a lot of property up in northern Wisconsin. But they do live in Illinois. I think they live in Lake Forest. Kevin Nicholson has obviously impressed Dick and Liz Uline to the point that they believe in him to the tune of giving him millions of dollars for his campaign. So Kevin Nicholson has built the relationships, the connections, the friends in high places in the private sector that demonstrate to me that he's got that executive experience that's necessary to be governor. So whether he's running for, I actually think I'd rather see him as governor than senator, but I'd love to see I'd like to see Ron Johnson run again. Ron Johnson, and I think he is. Ron Johnson is a great guy. Ron Johnson is a ball buster. Ron Johnson is a maverick. Ron Johnson is a take no bullshit. Ron Johnson is not a big government estate. Ron Johnson is a swamp drainer. And I hope that Ron Johnson stays in D.C. That would be have Ron Johnson stay in D.C. as a senator and Kevin Nicholson as governor. I'd take that pair up. So, I mean, if Jonathan Wichman, had the skill set to do something of scale, why didn't he do it in the private sector? The Beglinger girl, gal, I love her views, but I don't think she's got the qualifications. Rebecca Clefish could totally staff an administration, totally hit the ground running as far as big government Republican, but her administration would be full of Madison swamp creatures and that wouldn't get us where we need to be. Kevin Nicholson, total outsider. He would have non-Madison people, non-Republican Party people staffing his administration. And I think it'd be a good one. Here's another story I just want to share here real quick. I'm running over time here, but it's difficult because you turn on the news you got all liberal news, you turn on sports, you turn on entertainment, you turn on, you know, music, whatever. And you could just, you get this feeling that everybody's, you know, in the entertainment world, in the mass media world, unless you're watching Newsmax, unless you're watching One America News, unless you're reading the Epoch Times, even Fox News is run to the center, some might say left. So it really makes you feel like you're, and then it's by design to make you feel isolated, to make you feel like you're the only one that feels like you feel. That said, you saw how many people voted for Trump, and that was a pretty good indicator that you're not alone. I 100%. Would I bet my life that Trump won that election? I don't know if I'd bet my life, but I would bet almost every penny I have on it. I take all the money I have in the bank, like, because I'll make more money, you know, not putting my house or anything, not betting my house or my boat or my, you know, but just take the money I got in the bank, because I still, you know, I'm cash flow positive. I don't need the money I have in the bank. It would suck to lose it, but I would bet all the money I have in the bank that Trump won that election. But then when it comes down to, like, are people angry like you are? Do other people feel the way that you are? Again, there's no real way to, there's been some polls, and then you talk to friends and neighbors, and you think, you get this sense that, yeah, you think other people, look, I talk to a lot of people. Everybody's so pissed off, and it's hard to see because, like, look, I mean, Sheriff Clark has a rally by Mayfair Mall, and it gets a good attendance, but not great attendance. It's just not Republicans' things. Republicans, conservatives, they're not big ralliers. They're not big political protest march or tent. So you still sit there and you wonder, like, is there really this anger, this, you know, this frustration with what's going on? Are people really upset? Because it's sometimes hard to see it. But I got to tell you, so I got a new flag. I had a Trump flag, Trump 2020 flag. I put it up in front of my house about a month or two before the election. It's been up there. It was up there all last winter, my Trump flag. It's been up there all summer. It started to get a little tattered, and I started thinking to myself, you know, my neighbor, I've got a neighbor who's on the school board. She's a lib. She's an attorney. Her husband's like an engineer or something, and she snuck her way onto the New Berlin school board, total lib. And New Berlin's a very conservative area. And I think to myself, she probably gets so pissed. She's super active in the Democrat circles. And I'm thinking, she must get so irritated driving by, because my house is like at the entrance to our, I'm in a very small subdivision, only like 12 homes maybe back here on my little dead end street cul-de-sac. We're about 10, 12 years old now. And, you know, big houses, you know, probably the range of 600 to 750,000 in value. And I'm like the first one. I'm right next to this big HOA pond. My lot was the most expensive lot in the subdivision, but you got to drive right by mine. And as you turn into our subdivision, your headlights would sweep the front of my house in my front yard where my Trump flag is. So this lib, my neighbors at a lib has to drive by it every day. And I can't help but wonder, as my old flag was getting tattered, so I'd be like, I can't wait for that flag to blow away. It's getting old and tattered. Well, so now I got a brand new, fresh Trump flag, but this one says Trump won. And then little as under it says, I know it, you know it. So that's my new flag. It says Trump won. I'm eating dinner the other night. My doorbell rings. I'm like, what the fuck? Who rings a fucking doorbell at 7 o'clock at night or 7:30 at night on a Monday or Tuesday it was. So the doorbell rings. I go to answer the door, and lo and behold, it's like this 70-year-old lady, and she rings my doorbell. I answer the door, and she says, hey, I just wanted to tell you that I really like your Trump flag. And I was like, well, thank you so much. Thanks for stopping. I asked her name and told her I appreciate it, and told her, you know, there's a lot of people that feel like we do. How frustrated must people be? How helpless must, and how motivated must people be to want to do something, that they'd walk up a 70-year-old lady would walk up the driveway of my house. My house is, you know, kind of big and intimidating. I got outdoor lighting that lights up the front of my, I have a big stone front of my house that goes up 2.5 stories. And so the front of my house is lit up by spotlight, floodlight spotlight at night. So, you know, she came in the evening. It was, you know, my lights were on. It's just, you know, I got a big four car attached garage. It's a bit of an intimidating house, you know, and then there's Trump flag in the front. I've got stone pillars that are out. They're landscaping stone pillars out along the front near the road, like not in the easement, but as far out as you can get without being in the easement. So again, it's just a little bit of an intimidating looking house. And here's a 70-year-old lady who feels so compelled to say something that she walks up my driveway, walks up my front sidewalk and rings my doorbell just to tell me she likes my flag. So, I mean, for as helpless as we've all felt this past 9 months, for as frustrated and perhaps alone and dejected and depressed and mad and worried that we've all been, that our country is over, that the America as we know it is a thing of the past, I think there's something big and undeniable simmering out there. You know, it's anger, it's disgust, it's concern, it's helplessness, it's frustration, but it's big. I mean, I talk to a lot of people. Great story. This is what I was going to tell us earlier in the show, and I forgot. We went down to Racine on the yacht last weekend, not this past Saturday, not September 11th, but the week before. So that would have been September 4th. Took the yacht down to Racine. Awesome weekend, awesome cruise down to Racine. Racine has an amazing marina, super cool, big, great amenities, very well done. It's just, it's a great place to go and hang out. Had dinner at the Reef Point Brew House. So the marina has a nice big restaurant in the marina building, so you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to walk anywhere. Pool and two hot tubs it's a really nice marina. Just like Sheboygan's a really nice marina, just like Quarter Deck up in Sturgeon Bay is a really nice marina. But anyway, so we go down there. We have plans. We were supposed to go to Saugatuck 2 weeks ago, but the wave forecast was bad. So we decide we're going to go to Racine as an alternate. So we go cruise down to Racine on Saturday. A little bit rough going down there, but when we decided to go down there on like Wednesday, when we decided we weren't going to make it to Saugatuck because the waves in Michigan were going to be too rough, we decided to go to Racine. I make reservations at the Reef Point Brew House. Make the reservations for 2 for 7 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. Then I think it was Wednesday or maybe it was Thursday. I think it was Wednesday. No, maybe it was Tuesday night. I think I made the reservation Tuesday during the day. Tuesday night, I get home from my fiance's watching TV and I see on the news Wednesday morning that Racine passed the mask mandate. Well, I haven't put the communist face diaper of obedience on my face once yet this quote pandemic. I haven't, not once have I put a mask on my face, not for a second, not even once. And so not about to do it now. So obviously out of doors at the marina, I wasn't worried about it, but at the Reef Point Brew House, I was like, well, if there's a mask mandate, maybe we'll need to cancel our going to Racine and maybe we'll go to Kenosha instead. So I call down there on Wednesday to the Reef Point Brew House. I said, hey, yesterday I made reservations for dinner for Saturday. I don't know if I need to cancel them because I saw you guys that Racine passed a mask mandate last night and I don't do the communist face diaper of obedience thing. So I don't know if I need to cancel my reservations. And the girl answers the phone from the Reef Point Brew House says, oh no, it's okay. She's like, there's exceptions for medical and religious reasons and we don't ask, so if you don't have a mask on you'll be fine, no one's going to bother you. I was like, okay, cool, I respect that. So we go down there and I'm still worried about it. We walk into the Reef Point Brew House. Well, first we walk into the marina office. Nobody's got a mask on. The staff doesn't have a mask on, and again, indoors in Racine everybody's supposed to have a mask on. So that was good. When we walked into the marina, the marina manager didn't have a mask on. Then we go up to, when we had dinner at 7 o'clock at the Reef Point Brew House, it was packed. The Reef Point Brew House was packed. There was maybe 2 or 3 people that had masks on. The staff didn't have masks on. The patrons didn't have masks on. The diners didn't have masks on. And it wasn't just because they were sitting down eating. Like there was virtually no masks. And I was just like, yes, I love to see that defiance. I love to see, because that tells me the people are done with it, over it, and willing to buck the politicians, willing to buck the mayor, of Racine, Corey Mason, and the Racine Council. They're willing to, that's civil disobedience on the side of freedom, and I like to see that. So that was a great thing. But again, the 70-year-old that rings my doorbell, what I want to say is, again, all the people I talk to, I'm at the marina, some guy, people know, they bring it up with me because they know that I'm, my role with Wisconsin Carry, and that I'm politically involved. What do you think is going on in this country? I mean, everybody I talk to, frustrated, is worried, is scared, is, so if we can get free and fair elections, if we can find a way to have a free and fair election, and I think, I'm hopeful that we can. I'm thinking that we've seen enough, that we know where the cheating took place, even though we haven't necessarily passed any legislation to fix it or to clean. There's some things being done in enough places to where I feel like we might get a free and fair. Well, first off, midterms, those congressional races are run at the county level. So they're not statewide races. The House of Representatives, those are not statewide races. So if we take back the House in 2022, those, you don't have to worry about the Madison influence and the Milwaukee influence, because they have their own already liberal U.S. House reps. And it's these other parts of the state where you probably don't have the cheating mechanisms of Milwaukee County, of Dane County, that still have Democrats, which I think like the La Crosse area has some Democrats. But I would hope that they're probably hopefully going to have some free and fair elections out there. And I think that I think right now there's even some loyal Democrat voters that are so disenchanted with Joe Biden and with the direction of the country that even with massive cheating, it just wouldn't be possible. I don't want to knock on wood. I don't want to give Democrats too much credit, because I think we can always underestimate never underestimate the Democrats' ability to cheat. The ability of Democrats to cheat is far greater than we could possibly comprehend. So I don't want to jinx us by saying this, but I think that there are so many people, Democrats disenchanted with Joe Biden, with the direction of the country right now, that they couldn't cheat enough to steal an election again. It'd be such a monster landslide. So hopefully we sweep in control of the House of Representatives and get that under our control. And I think then you'll finally see, because that's the place where conservative anger comes out, is at the voting booth. These are people that don't have time to go protest. They're living their life, loving their families, doing stuff with their kids. They don't have time to do the protest thing and show up. And they know the fact of the matter is protests don't do shit. They really don't. Protests don't do shit. So, but that's something to share with you is everybody I talk to, people come up to me and just everybody's pissed and angry and disgusted and frustrated. And so, that gives me a little bit of hope that maybe there's a big, huge red wave coming, the likes of which a red tsunami that the Democrats have never seen before. And then we get control of the House, control of the Senate, and Trump back in there in 2024 with DeSantis as a vice president, which sets us up for 12 years, four more years of Trump and 8 years of DeSantis. Man, maybe we've got some good things ahead of us. I hate to be too optimistic, but anyway, that's the show for the week. I felt like that was a good show. We had a lot of good topics. I enjoyed it. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I hope it wasn't too indulgent telling you about the story about my grandfather. It strikes me as so like firsthand and so tangible that this wasn't, someone else. This wasn't some third party. This wasn't some documentary I saw on TV, but my grandfather's own writing, his own words, and right from his typewriter to my grandmother. Besides the personal connection of it, the reality that here's, it would be just if I went to a thrift shop and I found a letter in a trunk written from a guy and it was from 1944, I'd find that fascinating and historical but just add to the fact that it's from my own grandfather, and it just makes it that much more heartfelt, and driven. I had one other thing here where Joe Biden, was talking about how he's been patient with the mask vaccine mandate. Don't really have time to finish up on that. Maybe I'll hit that next week, but what a joke that guy is. Anyway, you guys have a great week. Carry on and be well armed. I hope you enjoyed the show. Shoot me a message if you did. Nick@wisconsincarry.org, and have a great week. Carry on. Be well armed.
This is Sniper Chick Julie. You've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.